Saturday View on Midlands 103. With thanks to Lumcloon Energy, pioneering innovation, powering progress. Lumcloonenergy.com. Have your say. Call 0818 300 103. Text or WhatsApp your Saturday View to 083 3010 103.
Well, a very good morning to you. Ronan Berry here. And as I just said, it's time for you to have your Saturday View across a range of topics. Coming up on the show between now and 11, we're going to look at that whole thing about cash in our communities and the major role that retaining or indeed having an ATM in the community can have. This is based on a local case study, actually, and I'll refer you back to Castle Pollard in around September 2022 when local people got up, took some action. So today you're going to hear about the impact that that action has had and what it has delivered for the community. It's a fantastic story in a week where the Access to Cash Bill has been published. And, you know, again, protecting our rights to use cash in society seems to be kind of a bit flabbergasting that we have to say that about protecting our rights. But anyway, you'll hear about that very shortly on the show. Also, we're going to be discussing an open letter to Laois Offaly elected representatives. It is written by a local peace activist from Port Laois who decided, you know, looking at all the news and hearing all the various cases brought to the International Court of Justice and stuff, has decided that she needs to take action and bring this to the attention of our elected representatives. So we'll hear more about that later in the show, what the expectations are and indeed whether there's been any response on that so far. And then in the middle part of the show today, we're going to explore the traditional and changing attitudes towards death and funerals and that whole afterlife and end of life stage, really. And I'll be joined by an interfaith minister from County Laois who will talk about, you know, those changing approaches and what people are seeking out now for funerals to commemorate people or afterlife or end of life ceremonies. She's also, you know, a reverend at, you know, weddings and other events too that are significant events throughout our lives. And it just represents kind of changing ideas, changing themes around how we do these things. And that topic of afterlife end of life is one that will feature a lot politically over the next couple of months or a couple of years, as it might be, because there is an Oireachtas Joint Committee on Assisted Dying. It was formed late last year. It has been quite busy so far in what it has been pursuing and what it has been discussing and hearing a range of views from across different stakeholders in that. And at the minute, there is a local Midlands TD who sits on that joint committee, so they'll give us an update later on what the committee has been working on and what it has achieved to date. So lots for us to get our teeth into this morning to sink in and get that discussion going. First, though, I suppose I better put a little shout out to a group of people who are probably feeling a little bit sad this morning, and maybe this music might give a little bit of a hint as to where I'm going with this. So Liverpool, of course, the news broke yesterday. I have to say, as I said to Aidan Barry before there, I am a Manchester United fan. But you know what? I'm saddened to hear that Jurgen Klopp is leaving Liverpool because, in fairness, what a character, what a manager, what a positive impact he has had on the Premier League. Indeed, on football in general, his record really is fantastic. Probably second only at the minute to someone like Pep Guardiola, which, you know, has been the benchmark. But what a man. Great respect for him, I think, and majority of football fans, I think, would concur with that. A huge influence on Liverpool as a club. As a United fan, you know, can't begrudge them the title they won a couple of years ago. He's got them back to where, you know, really, really flying again. So it was a bit of a shock for a lot of people when he decided he was leaving. But probably no surprise to hear that he was doing so for kind of personal reasons that, you know, he put so much emotion into what he does. And he said that in his statement yesterday, that he gives it his all. He puts his heart and he puts his soul into these jobs, and that is tiring. I suppose it begs a question too, like, imagine if we felt like that in our own jobs, if we went to our business owners, our managers, and said, you know, I'm just feeling really tired, I've put so much energy in and going to step down. How would they react? How would they greet it? I suppose we're talking different circumstances, huge millions of euro made every year by a manager of a top Premier League club like that. But is it too pressurised? And was he right to step down? And big questions as to who might replace him. But I had a really interesting suggestion for some Liverpool fans yesterday that I think the FAI need to pick the ball up here and really they need to take the ball and offer him the Irish manager's gig, because it'd be a part-time gig, wouldn't it? To give him a chance to, you know, be still be a manager, have great influence on a team. You can just imagine him fitting into the Irish culture and the people getting behind him. And he wouldn't have to be full-time. It wouldn't put as much pressure on him. So what's stopping them? Could you imagine that? Jurgen Klopp as the next Irish manager. Wouldn't it just be fantastic? But Ed, the chances of it happening are probably quite slim. But you know what? Let's put it out there. It would be great. Anyway, get texting 083 3010 103. Text and WhatsApp number, or give us a ring here on 0818 300 103. I mentioned at the start though, this week, the Access to Cash Bill was signed by in the Houses of the Oireachtas and will go forward and hopefully become legislation. But it does seem bizarre that we're even speaking about that idea of allowing people and to continue having access to cash in how we go about our daily lives and going to doctors, pharmacists. We've heard even on Midlands Today this week, you've heard from people representing those groups. We've heard from shop owners. We heard of everything, you know, anything that you need to do. You should be allowed to use cash. It's legal tender. It's the way it has always been. And it throws up other questions around, like, what would the society be like if we didn't have cash? And what is the impact of not having cash on all aspects of our rural communities, be it businesses and everything else that we're involved in? Well, I'm going to cast your mind back to September 2022, when the people in Castle Pollard decided to take action because the bank in the town, the last bank in the town, had closed the year before that in 2021. And they decided to take action and make sure that an ATM was kept in the community. And local business people got involved, a unit was purchased, the cash machine stayed. And that was fine. Huge objective achieved. It showed what, you know, people power can do. But to dig a little bit deeper and find out what impact it actually had and what it really means to the town of Castle Pollard, I'm delighted to be joined by the chair of Castle Pollard Local Development, Stephen O'Brien. Very good morning, Stephen.
Good morning to you, Ron. Delighted to be with you. Good morning to your listeners.
Stephen, this was, I suppose, you know, it was a story that back in September 22, I think, caught national attention too in terms of the media. And it really was a great example of local people standing up, taking action and saying, no, we're not allowing our cash machine to go. And that final kind of immediate access to cash that we have in our town. You took action. Tell us what's happened in the meantime.
Delighted to do so. Well, actually, if you think about it, in 22, September 22, when we kind of had that media splash because of our success, that was the end of that process. You know, we had, like many towns across Ireland, I think 88 towns across Ireland had woken up in March 21 to the announcement that the Bank of Ireland were withdrawing branches, you know, and decimating the local branch network to a great extent. I think four branches closed in Westmeath alone. And it was some months later before the actual branch closed in Castle Pollard, and then a few weeks after that, the ATM service was withdrawn. And we recognized then the damage that could be done in terms of the local economy and the cash economy, but the local economy generally. You know, there was a decrease of footfall reported, and there was less kind of incidental spending in terms of interviews we kind of undertook. Now, we had to wait some time before we could really act. And the reason was that the Bank of Ireland branch, former branch, I should say, went onto the market. And we couldn't act until there was a new owner. And luckily, and this was a kind of an aligning of events here, David Murphy of Murphy's Home Value Hardware purchased that bank building. It's adjoining his business anyway. And obviously that made sense to him. But he was willing to work with us to entice a third-party ATM provider. In this case, it was Euronext, who are, I think, quite fairly familiar across Ireland now, to come to town. And the key advantage we had was the infrastructure at the bank was there, the security infrastructure was there, the planning permission was there. So Euronext were tempted to come to town, and it's been a tremendous success since that happened.
And you say people are probably very familiar with that name, Euronext, because I think something like 80% of the ATMs nationally are actually owned by third parties. And anybody that has been in the square in Castle Pollard, they probably actually know where the ATM is. You were fortunate that it's actually outside. It's facing out onto the street as opposed to being inside in the branch.
Exactly. It's very prominent. You couldn't miss it coming through the town. You know, and in terms of livery, it's yellow and blue. You know, you think it was put there for our Ukrainian visitors, but it's, as I say, very prominent, perfectly located for anyone passing through the town to stop. Now, as you say, the other type of ATMs typically are those store-based ATMs, but there you're limited to the store hours and the availability of cash within them, because they're typically restocked by the shops. But this one on the square is a full ATM, you know, the traditional hole-in-the-wall type structure, and it's restocked, you know, by a cash truck. I don't know the sequence. I'm not going to even pretend I know when that happens. But obviously, the stores that it has are very considerable. And I think that's evidenced by the kind of transactions that take place at the machine. And there are full year figures available for 2023.
And that's where this story gets really interesting, because I suppose, like, just to remind listeners, like, the access to cash bill, it's actually protecting that. It's putting obligations, or it will put obligations once signed into law, around it, you know, the operators, to ensure that they're kept stocked up with cash, that they're frequently topped up. Like you just said, you know, there is a frequent visit to it there. But a lot of this stuff actually, I think, wasn't regulated up to now, which is kind of surprising. But I suppose it's also the change in nature of it. But I guess when it comes to anything where there's local activism and people standing up and trying to take action, maybe sometimes someone could say, well, look, do you know what's going to happen there? The ATM's going to go in. Very few people are going to use it. The operator's going to turn around and say, look, there's not enough activity on it. It's not viable for us to continue, so we're going to remove it anyway. But you have figures that is showing a slightly different story.
Absolutely. We're delighted with it. We understand in full year 23, some 36,000 individual transactions took place at that machine. Now, we obviously don't know the actual value, but if we take a minimum value of €50 for a typical transaction, that would, at a minimum, indicate something like €1.8 million moved through that machine. And that's being very, very conservative. It could well be a lot more than that, you know. So it does underline how correct we were to pursue it as a local group, a local volunteer group, at the time, because it made a difference to our local economy. But although we welcome the government's announcement, I think it's important to know that it's announced now. We have the heads of the bill. It could be a long time before it's passed. It may well change in substance before it's enacted or delivered on. But the key date in it is, I think, December 22. That's when the ATM network will be reverted to in terms of what it looked like. In December 22, Castle Pollard had no banks and had no bank ATM machines. We did have a third-party machine, but they're not going to be covered at the moment in terms of that infrastructure proposal from the government, as far as I understand.
That's it. I think the proposal is that the legislation will aim to maintain the infrastructure at December 22 level. So I think that's it. It's not to automatically assume that things were very healthy and rosy back then, and it's to look at what the reality was and what's been maintained in it. But I know when Noel Keenan from Castle Pollard Local Development was on Midlands Today, I think back in September 22, he paid huge tribute to the local people, the community effort. And there was expectations there in the sense that this will make a difference in the community. What have been some of the benefits from this that maybe were unexpected at the start, but now that you know, like, that this, given that level of money that you're saying, like, and which could be a modest figure of almost €2 million a year through that machine, what impact is that having there in Castle Pollard?
Well, I think it just has the possible effect of stopping people leaving town necessarily to avail of cash. You know, and it keeps cash in circulation in the smaller shops, the cafes. You know, that incidental spend that people might make is more typically made with cash, perhaps with an older cohort of people. But nonetheless, many people do prefer cash, regardless of that. And I think, again, it's just an extra service in the town. And when you start to chip away at those services, when they're removed, you know, how sustainable life is in a rural town can be measured by the availability of those kinds of services. Once they're gone, as you say, if there's a fear that they're gone for good, it chips away at that kind of livability of a town. So it's important to hold on to them and retain them if possible.
Yeah, because so many towns around the Midlands, you know, you drive through many. If you were to go from the station near the studio in Tullamore to Castle Pollard, there's a number of towns you go through where the story is replicated, albeit bar still having access to cash. And it was something that maybe was a bit people were dismissive of, thinking that, oh, it's all going to go contactless. But the numbers that you're talking about there, the impact it's having, shows that people do need to take action. If you had some guidance for people as Castle Pollard Local Development, if they wanted to start trying to do this and at least preserve what they have, what kind of tips would you give them?
Yeah, well, I would say it's important to be active for sure. You know, you can't assume that the machine, if it's there, is going to stay. I think as well, you have to look at other options, and the kind of the physical structure of the location of the machine, where the ownership lies, and who might come, who might be enticed to come to provide that service in future. I think it's kind of chilling and sobering, I suppose, to kind of think that had we not acted when we did, that money, that kind of quantum of money, would not have circulated in this town in cash terms. It may well have circulated in other ways, but it may not have circulated here at all, which is again a kind of a chilling thing to consider. And I think it's important to understand that although we're proud of what we've done in this instance, it's a success, it's a win for our group, Castle Pollard Local Development, it is in effect a small rearguard action against the closure of banks. You know, it is about ATMs and cash, but actually it's about the fact that the network behind that, the banking network itself, has been withdrawn. And again, just to return to the situation, when the Bank of Ireland closed, it was the third and last bank to leave Castle Pollard. You know, it was the last bank standing, and yet didn't maximise its services, its staff numbers, its days of operation, and make use of that local market. Instead, it chose to withdraw. And I think that tells me more about Pillar Banks and their attitude to customer service and their, you know, their desire for profits, that they will cut costs to maximise profits. And we have to understand that.
Absolutely. I mean, at even 1.8 million cash handling alone for a year would create a number and sustain a number of jobs, never mind all the other transactions that would take place. But Stephen, it's a great story, and I'm sure people will sit up and take notice and not just let the inevitable happen and actually take action. And now that you've got some stats and figures around that to show what it has done, the impact it's made in the community, it's a great story, and undoubtedly more to come from you all there. Thanks for that, Stephen.
Ronan, thank you. Do appreciate it. And for anyone interested, our website is castlepollard.ie.
Perfect.
Nice speaking to you.
Thanks a million. Thanks, Stephen. Stephen O'Brien there is the chair of the Castle Pollard Local Development. And again, great example of what happens when people can take action, stand up and just not let that inevitable happen and keep that money flowing through the local community, like 1.8 million. And as Stephen says, that's possibly a conservative estimate. That's based on a typical transaction value of about 50 euros. It goes to show you what's happening in our towns and villages across the Midlands. Time for a quick break. After that, I'm going to introduce you to an interfaith minister from County Laois.
Saturday View on Midlands 183 with thanks to Lumclune Energy, pioneering innovation, powering progress. LumclunEnergy.com.
On that subject of cash, I had a text in there from a listener, and he asks a little question: can a retailer legally refuse cash to pay for goods? And again, that's a question that will be undoubtedly discussed and commented on in the coming weeks and whenever that legislation finally comes in. But if you actually look it up online, the answer actually appears to be yes, they can in certain circumstances, because it says while cash is legal tender, businesses don't have to accept cash in some circumstances. Individual transactions are governed by contract law. But at present, it means that as long as a business notifies customers in advance that they can only accept payment in certain specified methods, they can legally refuse cash. So in December last year, which actually I think refers back to 2022, again, that period that Stephen O'Brien was talking about, the then Finance Minister, Pascal Dunne, who confirmed this in a written Dáil answer, is that if a business specifies payment must be in a form other than cash, the customer cannot subsequently claim a legal right to pay in cash, even if that cash is legal tender. So I think, John, the answer to that question is they can under certain circumstances, which probably covers everything and gets me off the hook with that question. If only we had an accountant or somebody to come on and explain it to us in more detail. But the next part of the show, we're going to look at that whole idea of the end of life, you know, and conversations we have or maybe don't have. And we all know Irish people seem to do debt quite well. We certainly do the initial stages of the grief, the getting behind our neighbours or friends, the wake, you know, nothing like an Irish wake, really, to really remember somebody and commemorate a life lived. But sometimes maybe afterwards, you know, and statistics this week showed that majority of Irish people, up to 73% of families, don't avail of grief counselling after a loss. And that's maybe something that maybe we don't engage with. And is there a reason why? And maybe there's a sense that we don't do that very well. Do we plan that? Do we know if we know end of life is coming? Or is it something in our early 20s or 30s that if we're putting a pension in place, could we put plans in place and actually have those discussions? But that throws up a whole question around things like assisted dying. And there is a joint Oireachtas committee that was formed to look into that very subject matter. In a little while, you're going to hear from a local TD who sits on that committee. But that whole question of preparing for end of life and what changes are happening, you know, are our attitudes and approaches changing from the traditional funeral and the way things happened and maybe talking about it or not talking about it? And what are the more modern ways or more common ways of doing things now? Well, let's dig a little bit deeper into this. I'm delighted to be joined by Bernie Brophy. And Bernie is from County Laois and she is an interfaith minister. A very good morning, Bernie.
Good morning, Mona. How are you?
Bernie, can you tell us, what is an interfaith minister?
An interfaith minister, well, is someone who prepares ceremonies for people, you know, that would be an alternative type of a ceremony. So maybe for a wedding ceremony, they mightn't want to do the traditional going to the church piece. So they would ask me to prepare a ceremony and officiate for them. And I can do the legal part of the ceremony for them as well. So it would be, yeah, and funerals and baby blessings. And so that's what an interfaith minister is. As well as that, we would do, say, counselling for people if people wanted to speak about something that's bothering them and just that kind of thing. Yeah, that's what an interfaith minister is.
How did you become an interfaith minister, and was there much actual training and stuff involved in doing so?
Yeah, well, I was in a health food store one day and there was a magazine, and I just saw, when I was reading the magazine, there was a tiny little advertisement that said, did you ever dream of being a priest or a minister, or, you know, of doing ceremony for your community? And for some reason or other, that just jumped out at me, because that was something I think that I always had a wish for. And I suppose being a Catholic woman, that door was closed to me. So I just jumped at the opportunity, and it was in London, the training, and it was a wonderful training. And there was people from every religion and people of no religions doing this training. And it was lovely. And it was like, it was a 2-year training. The first year we looked at all the different type of religions, you know, like the Catholicism, I suppose, and the pagan faiths and Judaism and on. And then the second year, then we looked at ceremony, and we did it in a lovely way, in that we had to ask ourselves, how would we have liked to have been celebrated when we were born? What type of ceremony would we have liked? And then moving on to, say, coming of age and marriage and, say, moving into being a mother or not, or, you know, so, and then death. So it was very much looking at it from your perspective and how would you like that. So it was a great inquiry, and it really got you thinking and talking, particularly when I'd come home and I'd be chatting to the family. And, it, you know, it was lovely. It was a very social as well as a very informative thing to be doing, you know.
Well, one thing that certainly hasn't changed is that if you are Catholic and you are a woman, you are prohibited from being a priest or a senior minister within the Catholic Church too. So is that a kind of, again, I suppose things haven't changed a lot there in forever, really. Are people's approaches, attitudes, what they want at end of life stage, are you seeing any cultural changes there? And is that indeed propelling more people to reach out to people like yourself?
Oh, I see a huge, huge change. And I think for a while, a lot of people, you know, didn't really want to have religion in their lives. It didn't have an awful lot of meaning. Now, for so many people, religion is such a big part of their lives. And for them, there is something there. But for the other people, there isn't. And so, you know, I've been to funerals where, you know, you go to pay your respect. There's no ceremony. There's no nothing at all. And then there's a cremation maybe the next day without any words or anything. And, you know, I have always had a sense that, it, you know, the family would have liked something, but there wasn't really an alternative, you know. So I feel that, you know, that there needs to be an alternative for people, particularly now, I suppose, when, you know, the numbers of priests and nuns are dropping so much that, you know, the whole religious landscape of Ireland has changed so much. So, yeah, I think that, you know, there's a great need for an alternative for people. And there, you know, that's probably why I, you know, I'm doing what I do, because I see the need for it, you know.
Is there a chance that if people have disengaged from the church, does that also disconnect them from a potential community that might be there to support them through it? Or are the communities at large still well able to gather around people at times of grief?
No, yeah, I think that the whole practice of how we look after the dead in Ireland has not changed. It's so, so deep rooted, you know. I mean, still that example that I gave you of going to someone's house, the neighbors still came in, and there was still the lovely sandwiches and all the things that you expect, and there was a lot of chat, but it was kind of like it lacked, what would you say, there was no sort of central point where the person was remembered. There was just a little absence of something. And the family, I spoke with them later, they kind of said this to me, you know. I mean, this was before I did this training. But, yeah, I mean, no, I do think we still have a very strong tradition. But, I mean, some of the older traditions are gone. And I think some of the older traditions were absolutely so powerful that we don't realise what we've lost, you know.
Traditions such as?
Well, you know, the great old tradition, I suppose, of the keening. I mean, that was something that happened in every house. Now, I only ever remember once experiencing the keening, but like there was always a group of women. It was usually women, and they came to the house, and they would cry, they would wail, and the whole idea really was, you know, that they would kind of, you know, allow the family to kind of grieve without any sort of shame or embarrassment. And there was also a sense that it allowed you know, the body or the person to sort of go on to the afterlife. That was kind of the reason why they did things like that, you know. And there was always the old bits about, you know, stopping the clock, and that was kind of like, because you're creating a sense of timelessness, and mirrors were covered because I caught this.
Yeah, and most of that, absolutely, a lot of that still happens in a lot of our rural communities too. But other things have changed, like maybe less often are you seeing the, you know, the body go to the church the night before a funeral or whatever. You know, there's a lot of subtle changes there. But you mentioned that during your training, you looked at how your birth would have been celebrated in order to kind of create, you know, your kind of your ministry around that. Are people getting more open to talking about the end of life stage, do you think? Are people more likely to put that this is what I would like, or how I'd like my life to be remembered or celebrated?
I think they are, but the conversation has to be, you know, to be started. I don't think anybody is, I don't think a lot of people are going to start that conversation and start considering that. I think they look at the financial piece and they look at their will, but I don't know that they actually look at exactly how they would like their funeral and, you know, what they would like to have at their funeral. You know, so from that perspective, I don't think so. No, I think the conversation would have to be started. And I think there's great place, say, within maybe nursing homes or places like that where, you know, there could be somebody who would, I mean, even personally, I suppose, like myself, I could easily, you know, go to nursing homes or places like that where you could go in and start having these conversations with people, you know, who are probably near death in a way that, not challenging, but in a chatty kind of a relaxed way, you know?
Yeah, absolutely, because I suppose it is the one thing that we're all certain of. It's the one part of our lives that we know. We may not know when and how, but we know for a fact it is coming at some point. So it's a good question as to when that conversation should start. And I'd love to hear what listeners would say. 083 3010 103, when should we have those conversations? Should we go right back to school level and start talking about end of life? But Bernie, thank you so much for coming on this morning. I think we're going to start a conversation here, and undoubtedly it will continue over the next month, a couple of months as well. So I look forward to talking to you again on that.
Yeah, and could I just take just one moment just to say that my sister-in-law's mum, I've just got a text now to say she just passed. Her name is Maura Kelly, a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful woman. I'd just like to offer my condolences to the family. Thank you very much.
And I'll offer our condolences from Midlands 103 as well. Bernie Brophy is an interfaith minister. You can find Bernie at Ceremonies and Celebrations. Her website is ceremoniesforlife.ie. The whole topic of death and end of life and do we plan or can we plan? I mean, we can go very deep on this subject matter, and we can even begin to talk about things like assisted dying, because this is another conversation that's going to be had in this country over the next couple of years. It may end up with a referendum going to the people, but is it something that has to be put to the people legally? Well, to find out more about that, there is actually an Oireachtas Joint Committee on Assisted Dying. It is chaired by Michael Healy-Ray, the Kerry TD, and Midlands are represented on it by Robert Troy, TD for Longford Westmead. Very good morning, Robert. Can you tell us about the stated objectives of this Joint Committee on Assisted Dying?
Having me on. The committee was formed as a response to deliberations that were done previously by the Justice Committee in relation to looking at introducing assisted dying into this country. There was a committee established with a clear time frame that it would look at this proposal and report back to the Oireachtas within 9 months. That 9 months is almost concluded. We're due to report back to the Oireachtas by the end of March. And the work, the committee has been really busy since it was formed just before the summer recess last year. We've had extensive public consultation and public sessions where we've heard from expert witnesses across a variety of modules, such as looking at the constitutionality, looking at the legal parameters, looking at international practice, looking at medical opinion. So we've had, as I say, a very varied number of witnesses and experts before the committee, and we've looked at how this has been introduced in New Zealand and Canada and Belgium and Holland. We've looked at, we've heard from our own legal people, we've heard from our own medical people, and ultimately now it's going to be the responsibility of our committee to bring forward a report. And now that report may make a recommendation to keep the status quo, and we know the status quo is it prohibits people from assisting someone to take their own life. It may well be looking to introduce some form of assisted dying and with robust protections and regulations in place. And I suppose that we don't know what the recommendations are going to be until the public hearings conclude and all the members of the committee get down to working in private session and bring forward a recommendation. At the moment, it looks like that recommendation or that report will be published the last week in March.
If it comes then to, if that report were to recommend a change in legislation, then is that likely to be put to the people of the country in the form of a referendum?
Well, the constitutional advice that we've been given is very clear, and that is that it doesn't necessitate a referendum, unlike the repeal of the Eighth Amendment, which did necessitate a referendum. We're told this wouldn't necessitate a referendum, but of course that doesn't mean that the government couldn't take a decision to put it to the the general public anyway. But no, to answer the question directly, it doesn't legally require a referendum.
But it could be the type of a subject that will be that could be potentially put to the people as well, I suppose, given the magnitude of it. You've mentioned other countries that have changed or adapted their legislation to allow for assisted dying. Do you think, as Ireland, you know, we're that little outlier, that rock on the western side of Europe as well. Do you think the Irish approach, as Irish beliefs, maybe will it be a different approach taken in this country? Do you sense, or because I know by the committee that's established there is kind of multiple perspectives, I can imagine, within that committee alone.
The committee is very varied, and it is a good cross representation of political parties, but also, I suppose, views in terms of people who are conservative in nature and people who are more liberal. The one fear that I would have is that where assisted dying has been introduced in other countries, sometimes starting off very tight, only permitted in very limited circumstances, such as with a terminal illness diagnosis, that unfortunately it becomes broadened over a period of time. And I suppose that's a big concern that a lot of committee members would have, that even if we were to introduce assisted dying in very limited circumstances, like where a terminal illness is diagnosed and someone is going to die within a defined period of time, that may be how it starts, but how it evolves over a period of time it may be broadened, and there's a concern there.
Thank you, Robert Troy. Robert Troy, of course, the TD for Longford West Meath, and he's a member of the Oireachtas Joint Committee on Assisted Dying. And if you check it out there on the Oireachtas website, you know, you can get the full transcripts of all the meetings and all the submissions they've had on the topic. And it's one that has been discussed, and there have been a lot of meetings about it over the last number of months. And as Robert said, their mandate was to revert and report back to both houses of the Oireachtas within 9 months of forming the committee, and they will come back with a series of recommendations based on what the committee has found. So that's a topic that is going to certainly be one for discussion. And in a year where there will be a general election, you wonder, will that actually form part of any kind of, you know, the people's, what people want to kind of get their views on in terms of the run up to a general election? So another topic that undoubtedly will revisit on Saturday View over the course of this year. A topic that few people have got in touch with is apparently a lack of access to GPs around County Offaly. And one listener from Belmont says he's 4 years waiting to get onto a GP's list. And somebody else near Shannon Harbour is also kind of saying similar, that there's a long and prolonged delays. So that's a topic that between Midlands Today next week, or certainly by Saturday View next weekend, we might have a deeper dive into. Time for a quick break. After that, we're going to hear from the Port Laoise-based human rights activist who has written an open letter to all elected representatives in Laois and Offaly about the ongoing genocide in Gaza.
Saturday View on Midlands 183 with thanks to Lumclun Energy, pioneering innovation, powering progress. LumclunEnergy.com.
Yeah, thank you for your text so far about the topics we've been discussing this morning. There are a few in around that whole kind of subject of assisted dying, and I know it's going to be a tough one. It's a contentious one. But just this morning's piece, it just highlights the level of what the government and parties have to look at and review because of the changing nature of life as we know it as well. And if you could have texted in, and one listener suggested that it's another way of trying to decrease the OAP numbers. Well, I can absolutely say it's certainly not that. And as Robert Troy pointed out there, it is trying to, you know, let Ireland look at what it needs or what its requirements are in line with what other countries are doing nationally. So a topic that will be debated at large over the coming years and months. It is a topic that if you put it in even to Google, just to look up the Oireachtas Joint Committee, it does give you indications too around your support groups like the Samaritans, that if it's a topic that affects people, reach out to someone like the Samaritans, samaritans.ie. Their phone numbers are there as well, because I say it's a contentious topic, and it's one that will undoubtedly be discussed and debated at large over the next while. But another thing that's currently being debated a lot is the Israeli actions in Gaza, like, and whether it is genocide and what internationally countries can do about it. Like in the Dáil just of yesterday, Cathal Berry TD pointed out that there are consequences to Ireland's actions in terms of whether it backs or doesn't back the South African case against the Israeli manoeuvres in Gaza, and he's warning that, you know, to keep Irish troops safe as well. So we know that the South Africans have put this case in the International Court of Justice. Well, locally, some other people are kind of trying to take action as well, and Laura Murphy is a human rights activist from Port Laois and has written an open letter to Laois Offaly elected representatives about Israeli genocide in Palestine. A very good morning, Laura.
Hello, Ronan. Thank you for having me.
Laura, I suppose just give listeners an overview. What compelled you to write this open letter?
I suppose it's actually today is International Holocaust Remembrance Day. And I think a quote from Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel sums up my intention and my impetus perfectly. He says that what hurts the victim most is not the cruelty of the oppressor, but the silence of the bystander. And just we all, for the first time in our history, we have access to witness genocide in real time. And what we're seeing at the other ends of our phone, on our TV screens, is horrific. Your previous segment about assisted dying is so important, you know, and that we give people that are dying and the dignity and the humanity and the comfort at that very traumatic, or what can be a very traumatic time in our lives. There's 30,000 Palestinian people who have been murdered. Maybe that number again, who have got caught under the rubble and had to die an extremely excruciating death. There are 13,000 children who have been murdered, and humanity and dignity are not words that can be used for the whole population of Gaza right now. So I think at a time when the US is actually funding this genocide, they're complicit in the genocide, our government seems to be in support of the US and so far has not taken any decisive action in support of the Palestinian or to have a ceasefire. So
in your letter, you're suggesting that this kind of maybe goes against promises or kind of comments made by some local elected people over the past couple of years.
Exactly, because I remember being at a pro-Palestine march in 2022 when there was bombardment by Israel at that time. And Deputy Sean Fleming, Fianna Fáil, he was there and he made an impassioned speech that I really felt had genuine empathy for the Palestinian people. And I remember thinking, he made promises back then, and I Googled it when I was writing this letter, and he did. He made a significant promise that he would do everything he could to help their people, and that it was very important that they press and pressure states like ourselves to put pressure on Israel and the other states that are supporting Israel. So now I'm looking to Micheál Martin, who blocked a motion, a very important motion by the Social Democrats, that Ireland would support South Africa in the genocidal case in the ICJ, and Micheál Martin blocked it. I at this stage, you know, we had 100,000 people in Dublin marching for Palestine. Our government leaders did not listen to them. At this stage, I'm bereft and I don't know what to do, but I feel that the power is in the hands of the people. So therefore, my communication is directly to our local representatives for them now to put pressure on their leaders to join South Africa in the case in the International Court of Justice.
And thanks a million, Laura, because that's a topic I think that we can absolutely follow up more on Saturday View, because I think there's going to be a lot more development on it in the coming weeks. It's something I'll come back to you on shortly. Thank you for your time this morning, and talk to you again soon. That's Laura Murphy there, a human rights activist from Portlaoise. Lorraine's here next after 11 with Saturday Feel Good Saturday. I'll talk to you next week.
Thanks to Lundclune Energy, pioneering innovation, powering progress. LundcluneEnergy.com. Bedlands 103.